there's a conversation about it, and that there are tools out there that we know can make a difference in bridging those gaps of understanding and mistrust, should make us optimistic.
The president has been telling a story about a law passed while he was an Illinois state legislator. It required police to keep data on racial profiling. That information showed the race of drivers stopped by police. The idea was to give police reliable information so they could better understand what they were actually doing. Police stops of black motorists went down. This year, the president has appointed a task force to explore similar issues on a national level.
I'm convinced that we actually are going to see progress on this issue next year.
Let me ask about another data point that reflects on the Democratic Party that you will want to leave behind in a couple of years. And this is something that has changed in recent years. As everybody knows, the coalition that's elected you twice included huge minority participation, record minority participation. You had huge percentages in minority communities. The white vote for Democrats has gone down to rather dramatic levels, which suggests a political division between races that is different than it used to be.
Yeah, but you know, data's funny. You know, you can, you know, what's the saying?
Lies, damn lies,
lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? So when I was elected in 08, I actually did better among white voters in some jurisdictions than John Kerry did.
And then 2012,
it might have dipped, but it was still on par with what had happened before. In the midterms, because of the nature of the electorate, it tends to exaggerate some of these racial differences. I guess my point being that I think it ebbs and flows, in part given circumstances. I do think that right now there are a lot of white working class voters who haven't seen enough progress economically in their own lives. And despite the work that we've done to try to strengthen the economy and address issues like child care or minimum wage or increasing manufacturing, that's not what they read about or hear about in the newspapers. They hear about an immigration debate, or they hear about a debate surrounding Ferguson, and they think, I'm being left out. Nobody seems to be thinking about how tough it is for me right now, or I've been downscaled, I've lost my job, et cetera. Part of my responsibility then is to communicate directly to those voters, and part of the Democratic Party's job is to communicate directly to those voters and say to them, you know what, we're fighting for you. And one of the best examples of this is the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, if you were just looking at the way it's been couched and characterized by the Republican Party, and in some cases by the news, the perception is somehow that this is largely something that is benefiting black and Hispanic and downscale voters. Well, the truth of the matter is that a state like Kentucky, that doesn't have a massive black or Hispanic population, has been one of the strongest states. Mitch McConnell's state's been one of the best states in using the Affordable Care Act to ensure huge numbers of working-class white voters. It's just they don't call it Obamacare. They call it something else. And so there's sometimes a gap in perceptions that we have to bridge. I think there's a legitimate sense of loss, particularly among men who have seen manufacturing diminish. Construction has been in the tank. The jobs that are out there are not ones that are traditionally jobs that blue-collar men aspire to. And you know, we've got to speak to those concerns. Now, the flip side is, nobody would be happier than me to see the Republican Party try to broaden its coalition. Immigration reform, by the way, was a great opportunity for the Republican Party to do so. The fact that I've received 75% of the Latino vote and 70% of the Asian American vote in the last two elections is something that the Republican Party should worry about, because it's actually fixable for them.
That's President Obama speaking just before the holidays in the Oval Office. It was an interview on radio and video, which you can find at NPR.org. We heard yesterday about the president's relations with Congress. Tomorrow, the president argues that his foreign policy is working more effectively than disastrous news events would suggest.
One of the things I've learned over 6 years, and it doesn't always suit the news cycle, is having some strategic patience.
We'll hear what he means tomorrow.
And we have an update now on the search for that jetliner that went missing over the weekend. Air Asia says they can confirm now that debris and bodies found in the sea off the coast of Indonesia are from that missing plane, which had 162 people on board. For the latest, we're joined by NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who's been following this from Beijing. And Anthony, what exactly has been found in the waters, and does this now put to rest any doubt about whether this was the plane?
Everybody seems pretty sure about it right now, David. Air Asia is citing Indonesia's search and rescue authorities, who confirm that what they found was indeed the plane that went missing on Sunday. They say that the plane went down in the Java Sea off the southwest coast of the island of Borneo. Earlier in the day, Indonesian media showed pictures of debris with the red and white colors of Air Asia and bodies being recovered. Now the search and rescue efforts will proceed to find the plane, which is believed to be in fairly shallow waters off that coast of Borneo.
And I guess, you know, the people following this news closer than anyone would be relatives of people on board who, if they had been holding out any slim hope, it's probably gone now.
That's right. There were about 100 friends and family members who were gathered waiting for news at the airport in Surabaya, Indonesia's second city where the flight originated, and they had to watch pictures on TV of bodies being recovered, and many of them were just overcome with grief on the scene. Recently, Indonesian President Joko Widodo and also the CEO of Air Asia, Tony Fernandez, have been at the airport offering condolences and saying that taking care of them is now first priority.
Well, are they getting any explanation for what might have happened to this plane?
There is still not a concrete explanation for what happened. The crew on this flight was very experienced. The airplane was only 6 years old, relatively new, and it was a short hop, a two-hour flight over a very well-traveled route. But weather conditions were not good, and the pilot requested to climb to a higher altitude to avoid storm clouds. But there were other planes at that altitude, and so permission was denied.
All right, that's NPR's Anthony Kuhn talking to us about bodies and debris being discovered off the coast of Indonesia, now being confirmed as from that plane that went missing over the weekend. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, David.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
The time is 8:18. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. You may have heard a few minutes ago President Obama say the country has become less racially divided since he took office, but some polling organizations say otherwise. At 8:33, we'll measure race relations in the United States. Our weather today is sunny and very cold, with highs in the single digits and the lower teens.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Begin your accounting career here and then finish your four-year degree at UW Parkside. Flexible, affordable, and profitable training for jobs that are waiting. To learn more, visit gtc.edu.
To make a Kwanzaa placemat and mini gingerbread house. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support seasonal activities for kids. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Relatives of those aboard Air Asia Flight 8501 are in mourning. At least 40 bodies and debris from the airliner were located today in the Java Sea off the coast of Borneo. The Airbus disappeared on Sunday during a flight from Indonesia to Singapore in stormy weather. New York Congressman Michael Grimm is resigning from office. NPR's Giles Snyder reports Grimm is a Republican first elected in 2010 who's pleaded guilty to tax evasion.
In the statement, Grimm says that he does not believe he can be completely effective in the next Congress that begins next week, and that out of respect for the office and the Staten Island district he represents, it's time for him to start the next chapter. House Speaker John Boehner has not publicly called for Grimm's resignation, but the two are reported to have met before Grimm's decision was made public.
A court in Russia is handing down a suspended prison sentence for a leading political opposition figure convicted of fraud. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg is in Moscow.
Alexei Navalny is the opposition figure the Kremlin fears most. A charismatic, anti-corruption campaigner turned political activist and a vocal critic of Vladimir Putin.
And the NFL is suspending Detroit Lions defensive tackle Ndamukong Suh for Sunday's wildcard playoff game against the Dallas Cowboys. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. More documents will be released today about the John Doe investigation into Governor Walker's aides and associates when he was the Milwaukee County Executive. Another 227,000 pages of emails and records will be made public. It's the fifth release of documents connected with the probe that resulted in convictions against a half dozen Walker associates on charges ranging from misconduct to embezzlement. Last week, ex-Walker Deputy Chief of Staff Tim Russell lost an appeal of his conviction for embezzling more than $20,000 from a program that honored Wisconsin veterans. Governor Walker says he's willing to look at changing from nonpartisan to partisan, the board that oversees elections in Wisconsin. Walker tells the Associated Press that he'll work with both Republicans and Democrats on possible changes to the Government Accountability Board. The board is made up of former judges and has been the center of criticism lately from Republicans who control the state legislature. The board oversees elections, ethics, campaign finance, and lobbying laws. Police in West Bend are looking for five men who robbed a jewelry store yesterday. Officials say they used hammers to break a display case at Hussar's House of Fine Diamonds late yesterday afternoon. The suspects reportedly fled with an undisclosed amount of merchandise and got away in a stolen minivan. Police later found the empty minivan in a parking lot in West Bend. Nobody was apparently hurt. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. More news at 8:42.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. On the web at pamm.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Markets in Greece were hammered after the country plunged itself into political turmoil by calling early elections next month. That's the bad news for Greece, but there is good news for the rest of Europe. Joanna Kakissis reports that this time around, the problems in Greece are not spreading to markets in the rest of the Eurozone.
The last time Greece held elections, in June 2012, everyone was panicking. A leftist party, Syriza, was rising in public opinion polls and threatening to fight Eurozone lenders who were keeping Greece solvent through billions of dollars in bailout loans. There was real fear Greece would leave the euro and take the rest of the Eurozone with it. But that's not the case anymore, says Wolfango Piccoli, a London-based financial analyst.
The ability of Greece, even in the worst-case scenario, to shake the financial market now is much more limited.
One reason is that 80% of Greek sovereign debt is now owned not by Greece, but by the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, the country's lenders.
So the ability of Greece to impact on the wider Eurozone now is significantly diminished.
But there's still unease. The leftist party Syriza is expected to win elections next month. It strongly opposes the bailout. That's worrying many in Europe, says economist Platon Tinios.
Well, they're not really reacting to a Syriza government per se. What they're reacting is against is a renewed period of uncertainty.
And that political uncertainty may spread to other economically vulnerable countries like Spain, causing more division in the Eurozone. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis.
To begin to understand the cycle of war and suffering in one part of Africa, it is worth meeting one man. His name is Daniel Majuk Guy. As a boy, he fled the civil war in Sudan, running miles by himself to safety, leaving his family behind. He was one of the so-called lost boys of that conflict. After years in refugee camps, he landed in the United States. He reunited with his family, got an education, and in 2011 returned home to what was now an independent country, South Sudan. But war came back and split that new nation. Daniel was forced to flee again, this time as a young man with a wife, infant son, and elderly father.
Running again to the bushes that I ran to when I was only 9 years old. It broke my heart. I was helpless.
That was Daniel when we reached him back in January. A year later, South Sudan is still in a civil war between factions supported by the president and his former vice president. The United States supported South Sudan's independence and thought this young country would be a rare success story in East Africa. But the violence just won't stop. As we close out 2014, we wanted to revisit Daniel, one of the more memorable people we met this year. We reached him in Nairobi, Kenya.
David Green, good morning.
Good morning to you.
It's nice to talk to you again.
Daniel is living with his wife and his son. His elderly father is still separated from them.
They are doing fantastic, I can say that. My father is still in a refugee camp in northern part of Uganda. And I spoke with him yesterday. He's doing fine. He's missing home, though. He's missing me. He's missing his grandsons.
One of those grandsons is Daniel's young son, who was an infant when he fell ill fleeing last year. He's doing much better now.
He can speak some few words now, daddy, mommy, and he's acting like the way I was acting when I was a child. So I can see myself in him.
Oh, that's great. Daniel's dream is that his son and wife can join Daniel's father and all can move back to South Sudan sometime in 2015. For now, Daniel's been taking trips in and out of the war-torn country, working with a nonprofit group called Project Education South Sudan. The group builds schools. In the area of South Sudan where Daniel's been working, 3,000 boys and girls have been out of class for a year now. Daniel sees hope in the story of one girl. She's 16. Her family so far has supported her completing her education before she marries. Her name is Anna.
And Anna is from the same community that I was born from. And she has three brothers and a mother. His father was killed during the civil war when Sudan was fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Anna did not have that much opportunity to go to schools. And what moved me about her is a passion of education. You know, education for girls in South Sudan is not that much. Girls are considered to be married only and start the family. But now Anna could see her future coming, and she wants to be a doctor. She's very good in sciences and languages. These three brothers of her promised her that we will never, ever push you to be married. We want you to go to school. So when I see her in a class of 50 boys, and she's the only girl in that class, and she will manage to get to the top of the class, I feel as if we are changing the nation.
You told me that you were 90% optimistic about the future of South Sudan in January.
Yes.
Are you still that optimistic right now?
I am still optimistic because of the people. South Sudan, that's where I was born. That's where my grandparents are. When I look at myself, I feel that it is a call for me as an emerging leader in our country, at least to do something to our people. And so I'm optimistic every single minute that no matter what, Sudan and South Sudan has been in war since 1956. But the generation is coming and go. So I think this is my time to do something to our people in the country.
Well, Daniel, I really look forward to talking again. I hope we hear good news about Anna, and I hope we hear good news about you and your family. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Daniel Majuk-Guy. He's a director with Project Education South Sudan, and he spoke to us just before taking another trip to do aid work in his home country. This is NPR News.
Gyms bank on members who sign up but never show up, so they may have a roster of 6,000 members.
What would happen if they all came?
Oh my goodness, we'd have a very crowded gym. Thank goodness they all don't show up at one time.
The model for success in the business of fitness, betting on the perpetual couch potato. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Right after classical music, this afternoon at 3. You can see our complete schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm David Green. The Miami Dolphins want to make sure you never have to miss another play because you were getting a beer. Thirsty fans can now have beer delivered to their stadium seats just by tweeting at BeerMe. Don't get too excited. The program is still being tested. At Sunday's game, only two sections of the stadium could use it, but things did seem to work well. The Dolphins hope to expand this program next season. Unfortunately, they can't use Twitter to order up a spot in the playoffs. You're listening to Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. We're glad you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. It has been 1 year since an oil train derailment in North Dakota, a crash that sent a huge fireball in the sky and forced the evacuation of an entire community. Since then, regulators have taken steps to make it safer to transport crude by rail. We'll take a look at that at 8:45.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series featuring some of our favorite interviews of the year with New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Her illustrated cartoon-style memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, is about her changing relationship with her parents in their final years and all the conflicted feelings that came with those changes. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio. It'll be very cold in Wisconsin today with sunny skies and afternoon highs only in the single digits and lower teens. Lows tonight plunging from 0 to 10 below. Another bitterly cold day tomorrow. Temperatures should start to moderate New Year's Day. We also expect highs in the 20s by Friday and Saturday, but also a chance of potentially heavy snow.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And from Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Obama sparked widespread disbelief with a statement the other day. We asked if he thinks America has become more racially divided during his administration. The president said no.
I actually think that it's probably, in its day-to-day interactions, less racially divided.
That statement to NPR News made headlines. This morning, as part of our year-end interview, Obama explains what he meant. He says, elsewhere in today's program, that this year's much-publicized racial incidents make people feel more divided than they are. So, is the president right or wrong? It's not easy to measure just how divided America is. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports on what is known.
There's one question pollsters at Gallup have asked since 1963.
Do you think that relations between blacks and whites will always be a problem for the United States, or that a solution will eventually be worked out?
Editor-in-chief of Gallup, Frank Newport, says the answer has stayed relatively the same since 2008 for about 60% of white Americans. They're optimistic, just like half of African Americans who responded in 2008 and 2013. But Newport says even though sentiments don't seem to have shifted during the Obama administration, there remains a significant gap between how whites and blacks perceive race and equality.
Blacks see a world that has barriers, structural barriers and discrimination. Whites, much less so.
Whites are more optimistic about race relations than blacks are, and if you look at other pollsters as well, you see similar trends.
Jocelyn Kiley is Associate Director of Research at another pollster, the Pew Research Center.
We ask, how well do blacks and whites get along with each other these days? Very well, pretty well, not too well, or not at all well.
Almost 70% said very or pretty well more than a week after protests began in Ferguson, Missouri. But that share was 7 points lower compared to a 2009 survey. Still, polling won't give you the final answer on race relations. According to a recent New York Times CBS News poll, they've stayed about the same since Obama became president. Or, according to Bloomberg Politics, they've gotten worse under the first black president.
We need to get beyond the opinions, beyond the ideas, and really ask, how is race working in terms of allocating power and resources in our society?
Ian Haney Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, teaches law at the University of California, Berkeley. He says a more objective way of measuring race relations is to look at how segregated we are as a country.
And that's to ask about the main institutions in our lives, our neighborhoods, our schools, our jobs.
Not to mention, Haney Lopez says, our most elite institutions like Congress and Fortune 500 companies. Peniel Joseph, founding director of Tufts University's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, says these socioeconomic indicators can tell you a contradicting story about the status of African Americans today.
From a privileged perspective, things are, yes, dramatically different. Those same folks in 1964, even with a Harvard degree, many, many doors of opportunity would be closed. But 50 years later, Obama is the president of the United States. But many, many African Americans don't have the same access.
Access that Joseph says is key to truly understanding race relations today. Hanzi Luong, NPR News.
Another thing that came up in Steve's conversation with President Obama was the news media. The president said the press hasn't focused enough on parts of his record, like improvements in the economy. In complaining about the media, the president can take a number behind most any politician on every side of every issue. And whatever your political views, the media do suffer from a certain attention deficit disorder. NPR correspondent Tamara Keith has finished her first full year in the White House briefing room.
In 20 seconds, here is 2014 in the White House press briefing room.
Happy New Year, everyone. It is great to be back.
Unemployment.
The Affordable Care Act.
Russia.
And Ukraine.
The VA.
General Shinseki.
The border crisis.
Immigration.
Syria.
Does ISIS.
ISIS.
The Secret Service.
Back to the Secret Service.
Ebola.
If there is a travel ban.
Eric Garner.
Ferguson. North Korea's.
Here we are in what is my last press briefing of the year.
The year started with one of those will-they-or-won't-they congressional dramas over renewing long-term unemployment benefits. Congress never did extend the benefits, and questions about it in the briefing room disappeared by the end of January. And so it went, with stories getting hot for a week, maybe three, and dominating the White House press briefing until the news cycle moved on. Unemployment was replaced by questions about Obamacare and then Ukraine. In the White House briefing room, interest began to build as pro-Russian forces moved into Crimea. But before long, that was replaced by the scandal of secret wait lists at VA hospitals. Here's ABC's Jonathan Carl in mid-May.
It seems that there was a cover-up to try to hide the true size of the backlog.
Over 2 weeks, the questions crescendoed, with reporters, including AP's Julie Pace, asking whether VA Secretary Eric Shinseki should keep his job.
And I'm wondering if the president continues to have confidence in the secretary's ability to lead that department.
The next day, Shinseki resigned. And questions about the VA essentially vanished from the daily press briefing. Amy Mitchell heads journalism research at Pew.
There was a huge spike for about 3 weeks, and then it just falls very, very quickly down to an extremely low level of attention in the mainstream media.
Since then, the VA says there's been an 18% drop in wait times for primary care appointments, along with other improvements, though the problems are far from solved. Another story that spiked was the Central American children crossing the U.S. border. Questions from White House reporters peaked in mid-July. Then, like so many stories, interest waned. In his year-end press conference, President Obama bemoaned the fact that no one seems to care that the situation at the border has improved.
It may not get fixed in the time frame of the news cycle, but it gets fixed.
But by then, the White House press corps had moved on to the next flashy thing, the military action against ISIS, followed by the White House fence jumper and lapses by the Secret Service. In October, it was Ebola. The deadly virus dominated daily briefings for 3 weeks amid questions about whether it could spread in the U.S. Pews Mitchell says strained resources at the nation's news organizations are at least partially to blame for the short attention span. She says there are fewer reporters who can linger on a story, and that makes for a more reactive media.
As that happens and you become more reactive, the news cycle is also speeding up, and the media can in many cases find themselves jumping around from event to event and issue to issue to try to just stay on top of what's being rolled out on a daily basis.
And the White House press corps, with its televised daily briefings, is a microcosm of the national media as a whole. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. The Marketplace Morning Report, 10 minutes from now, will take a look at how the American manufacturing sector has fared in 2014. Our weather forecast today, sunny and very cold, with highs in the single digits and lower teens, and lows tonight from 0 to 10 below.
Gyms bank on members who sign up but never show up, so they may have a roster of 6,000 members.
What would happen if they all came?
Oh my goodness, we'd have a very crowded gym. Thank goodness they all don't show up at one time.
The model for success in the business of fitness, betting on the perpetual couch potato. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3, then stay tuned for Marketplace at 6:30.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Bodies and debris from Air Asia Flight 8501 have been found floating in the Java Sea off the coast of Borneo, but investigators still haven't pinpointed a debris field or the airliner's black boxes. That plane went down in stormy weather on Sunday during a flight from Indonesia to Singapore. But aviation expert Philip Butterworth Hayes says the weather is only one factor being looked at.
Could be technical issues. Could be the pilot not getting the right information at the right time about the weather conditions. But it's never just one thing. It's always a chain of events.
The results of an autopsy show Los Angeles police shot a 25-year-old suspect 3 times at close range during a confrontation back in August. Sharon McNary with member station KPCC reports police say the findings are consistent with the suspect trying to grab an officer's gun.
This autopsy was held back from public view for more than 4 months. The LAPD requested that it not be released to the public so that it wouldn't interfere with the LAPD investigation, so that it wouldn't color people's stories one way or the other.
The family of the man killed by police have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit. The National Weather Service says Las Vegas might see snow flurries on New Year's Eve. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News. In Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin is in the midst of its coldest temperatures of the season thanks to clear skies and cold Canadian air. It was 23 degrees below zero in Tomahawk at 7 o'clock this morning, and it was minus 10 as far south as Marshfield. Winds remain light or non-existent, so that keeps wind chills not as cold as they could be. Tonight, the deep freeze will make its biggest plunge with wind chills of 20 to 30 below again in northern and central areas. For New Year's Eve, revelers can expect lows in the single digits and teens going into 2015. Light snow is possible Thursday night, with heavier snow possible this weekend. Almost 5,000 state government employees got merit pay raises from January through October, and more than 80% of those raises went to University of Wisconsin employees. More than 3,100 state workers had their base pay raised, while another 1,700 got one-time lump sum bonuses, which totaled $3.5 million. Many university raises went to custodians, food service workers, and information technology personnel. Campus officials said they gave merit raises to people who picked up extra duties in the midst of job cuts and tighter budgets. A Wisconsin state senator will again try to let more families sue for wrongful death in medical malpractice cases. Milwaukee Democrat Nakia Harris-Todd says that her proposal would allow lawsuits from parents of children who die from malpractice before the age of 27, thus letting parents of college-aged children seek damages. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org. From the Joyce Foundation, working to encourage businesses and consumers to save money and electricity through energy efficiency. JoyceFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. The oil boom in North America has raised a question. How do you transport that much oil safely? Well, a year ago today, a train carrying North Dakota crude derailed and exploded outside the small town of Castleton, North Dakota. This came on the heels of a deadly derailment in Quebec. These incidents were a wake-up call for trackside communities, and regulators have been trying to make it safer to transport crude oil by rail. Emily Guerin from Prairie Public Radio reports on how secure residents of Castleton, North Dakota are feeling these days.
It was just after 2 p.m. when two trains collided in a cornfield near Castleton, a farm town of 2,500 just outside of Fargo. One was carrying soybeans, the other crude oil from North Dakota's Bakken oil fields.
When I first heard about the derailment, it was actually the explosion that I heard because I was coming into town to get the mail.
Ed McConnell was mayor of Castleton at the time. Sheriff Paul D. Laney and Fire Chief Tim McLean responded to the crash.
We got just outside the city limits of West Fargo when I saw a massive fireball, and we were still 12 miles away.
And it was just an eerie sound, like the cars were taking their last gasp of air.
Amazingly, no one was hurt. Up to 40 oil trains pass through here each week, headed for refineries on the East and Gulf coasts. Fire Chief Tim McLean says before the crash, he never thought crude oil could explode like that.
We learned a lot after this. I think everybody across the United States learned a lot after this one.
In the years since, the U.S. Department of Transportation has begun drafting new regulations to make it safer to ship oil. Railroads have agreed to slow down trains. Oil companies say they'll begin to phase out old tanker cars. Perhaps the most significant step came earlier this month when the state of North Dakota passed rules to make the oil less flammable before it's loaded onto trains. Does any of this make anyone in Castleton feel safer?
I don't know what they're going to have to do to make me feel safer. I still, every time I see an oil train, I always wonder.
Former Mayor Ed McConnell says in his dream world, pipelines would replace trains. But he knows that's not going to happen anytime soon. In the meantime, he still worries. But a lot of people here apparently don't. Jessica Forder works at Hardware Hank, less than 100 feet from the train tracks.
Yeah, it's just part of life.
The train derailment didn't faze her, even though she sought professional help for her young daughter, who was traumatized by the crash.
The railroad was here first. The town was built around the railroad. So for us to say that they shouldn't be, you know, coming through here isn't feasible either.
Nationwide, oil train traffic has increased nearly 50-fold since 2009. And that's likely to continue because many of the East Coast refineries that want Bakken oil can't get it by pipeline. Many people in Castleton are tired of the media attention that the train crash has brought. Former Mayor Ed McConnell worries that people might think twice about moving here.
It always was a worry of mine that we would become the poster child for a railroad oil explosion. And there's so much more to Castleton than that.
What Castleton should be known for, he says, are its good schools and fertile soil. He's confident that the risk posed by oil trains will be reduced and Castleton can once again be known as safe, not just unscathed. For NPR News, I'm Emily Guerin.
Emily's story comes to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. This is NPR News.
It's almost 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Morning Classics begins at 9 o'clock. Today's highlights include music by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Haydn. Join Ruth Ann Bestman right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
Drive in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Our weather for Wisconsin today, sunny and very cold, with afternoon highs in the single digits and lower teens. Lows tonight from 0 to 10 below. Another cold day tomorrow, but temperatures should start to moderate late tomorrow night. New Year's Day, highs in the teens and low 20s. Friday and Saturday, a chance of snow with highs in the 20s. That snow could get heavier this weekend.
Support for WPR comes from Florentine Opera, presenting Wuthering Heights with international artists, Florentine Opera Chorus, and Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, January 9th and 11th at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center. Tickets at florentineopera.org.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
A nervous run-up to New Year's on stock markets.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Investors in Europe have been moving their portfolios away from risk in the days since it became clear a new general election will happen in Greece in the coming weeks. Key stock indexes in many of the countries that use the euro are down about 1%, from Germany to France and even in the UK, which has its own currency. On Tuesdays, as stock markets open in the U.S., we consult analyst Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis.
Everybody's been expecting another grease fire for some time, and here it is. The big thing is, who's going to foot the bill? You've had everybody looking the other direction in terms of financial stability, and that's what's gotten them into this huge problem. The only way to keep it together at this point is to kick the can further down the road. Put your blinders on. But I think this is going to be the year that Europe really decides whether or not this union is viable, and that'll create some real consternation in the European markets.
Also, after a brief rise yesterday, the Texas price of crude oil is down at $53.43 a barrel. It was above $100 6 months ago.
This is high excitement for oil. And, of course, now you're hearing all the sobs coming out of the oil-producing countries that this is going to cause a global depression. Absolutely the opposite is true. At this point, we're still looking at excess production. We have plenty of energy. You'll see a lot of marginal production here in the United States, namely the gas frackers, who were unable to get the good pricing that they need to justify all the debt they took down. Those are the people who are going to bite the dust. But this is the best thing that could happen for consumers. When you're putting it into the grocery cart and not to the gas tank, that means you're going to have global economic growth from that standpoint.
Analyst Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Let's check the numbers from the markets. The Dow is down 31 points, 0.2% to 18,006. The S&P 500 down 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 0.1%. The rise of home prices in major U.S. cities slowed down in October, but not by as much as forecast. Another way of looking at it, home prices were up 4.5% compared to the same month a year earlier. The last snapshot of American consumer confidence for the year will come out in a matter of minutes. The industry group known as the Conference Board has the data, and things are expected to be looking up, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Consumer confidence has been rising all year and is now back to levels we hit before the Great Recession. Economist Chris Christopher at IHS.
people expect the economy to improve and their personal finances to improve.
Certainly true if you own stock, with repeated records on Wall Street. But why is it true for middle-income folks, with long-term unemployment still stubbornly high and wages more or less stagnant? Analyst Bernie Baumol says you have to look at the bigger economic picture.
We've got the best job growth that we're seeing in 14 years. Companies are benefiting, as well as consumers, from lower gas prices, from the lowest cost of borrowing in history.
But Baumol still cautions, until the global economy returns to health, U.S. companies might not feel optimistic enough to go on a huge hiring spree or raise wages. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
10 trains pulled into the station right on time is not the definition of news, but a delivery tracking company reports that UPS and FedEx got most of their packages to their intended recipients in time for Christmas. 98% success for express packages, according to Ship Matrix. A year earlier, the media labeled it a fiasco when FedEx's on-time rate was 90% and it was 83% at UPS.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by PrecisionCore technology, providing a full line of workforce printers designed for home offices, small offices, and networked work groups. Learn more at Epson.com. By Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And by Regis, providing total office solutions for startups to Fortune 500s. Fully furnished, staffed, and ready to plug in and get to work. 1-800-OFFICES.
I like to say it takes a big man to go on national radio to reveal his ignorance, and I am that big man as I turn to face Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com, with his challenging quiz questions that he brings to us from time to time about our globalized world and our economy. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning, David.
All right, do your worst. What do you got?
Well, we've all heard GE's Jeff Immelt and others talk about the new manufacturing renaissance, and we see it on magazine covers and stories without end. My question is very simple today. What percentage of U.S. jobs does the manufacturing sector account for today? A, 1.5%, B, 8.2%, C, 12%, or D, 30%?
It's not going to be 30%, but what was the penultimate choice? It was like 12-point-something% was one of your choices? All right, that's going to be my guess.
It is correct if I had asked you something else, which is what's the share of GDP that manufacturing counts for, but employment, no.
Okay, but the percentage of jobs.
Correct.
Okay, so with efficiencies, with productivity enhancements, it's going to be a smaller percentage of jobs that it creates for us.
Very good.
So 8%.
Very good. But here again is the kicker. By and large, the jobs that are coming back through onshoring or homeshoring, they don't pay any really good wages anymore, like they refer to from the past. Many of them are basically at will, like call center jobs, people walking into the plant in the morning, don't know how many hours they will get to work, they don't have benefits and so on. So there's a big dichotomy here. On the one hand, in the media we hear all the time, U.S. manufacturing is back. By implication, all the great old manufacturing jobs are back. But by benefit pay and so on, no way. What they're bringing back is sort of the cheaper jobs from India and Mexico and so on, where there's not a level of sophistication that it's worth the travel distance and all of that. But it is not a great manufacturing renaissance in the United States by any means at this stage.
Well, thank you for the quiz, Stefan. You can follow Stefan Richter on Twitter at The Globalist or online via TheGlobalist.com. Stefan, thank you.
Thank you, David.
And there's news that central bankers in Britain are keeping an eye on social media for a sense of how the economy is doing there. The Bank of England's chief economist told Sky News that official statistics can lag and are subject to revision. Quote, what this scraping of the web can do is give us a better today read on what's going on. If the Federal Reserve were to try this, imagine the possibilities. Perhaps we could collectively help delay the moment interest rates go up by tweeting day and night about what a hassle it is to find a job or to get a raise. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you throughout the day with headlines from NPR and WPR at noon, All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30 this afternoon, and stories to listen to, read, and comment on anytime at WPR.org.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Spruce Tree Music and Repair, Pabst Theater, and Sprint Print play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
Attention all Facebook users, you're invited to click Like WGTD for breaking news, photos, station program information, links to archives, and to interact with WGTD employees and listeners. The page is available to non-Facebook subscribers as well. You're listening to WGTD HD,